Thank you for the invitation. Well, I'm going to talk about wealth, health, and happiness, and I'm going to combine these concepts, I suppose, that are not usually combined. I want to talk about three questions. The first is something that Mr. Cameron touched on, and that is, in this century largely to come, should we be giving up, approximately speaking, the goal of caring a lot about, or maybe even trying to maximize GDP, gross domestic product? And I believe, roughly speaking, we should give that up, at least in the rich Western part of the world, though not in the developing nations. I'm part of something called the Stiglitz Commission. I'm afraid I don't know how widely known this is yet, but it was set up by Mr. Sarkozy and will report in the spring. And one possibility is that we'll suggest what society should try and maximize if and when it gives up the concept of maximizing GDP. Second, I want to ask what actually happens to somebody when they get a lot of money. I have taught a large number of undergraduates in this university and other universities with the who leave with the goal, perhaps even they come with the goal, of trying to get an enormous amount of money. Some students want to earn millions of pounds. Is there any way that scientifically we can evaluate what will happen to their psychological well-being if they do get pots and pots of cash? And number three, this may seem the most unfamiliar to you. I'm prepared to guess that by 2050 these ideas will be commonplace, but of course, how can we tell for sure? I want to talk about how physiological measures, my heart rate, which is slightly elevated at the moment, I think, and my blood pressure and so on, might actually be used as part of an index to replace gross domestic product. I've no way of knowing if that seems absolutely crazy or a wild idea to you, but I'm going to try and present some data consistent with the notion that we should be taking readings of physiological things as well as gross domestic product and happiness in the future. So is our society going in the right direction? I'd like you to go away, if you don't know it already, knowing the Easterlin paradox, named after my friend Richard Easterlin, who is in a USC hospital doing very well today in California. He just had a major heart operation yesterday. He's 85 approximately. And he is famous for a number of things, but one of the most important is this kind of graph. And although economists for some decades didn't listen to this, if you take random samples of Americans and ask people in exactly the same way every year, how happy are you with your life, then through time those numbers don't rise, they run flat. GDP, of course, trends up tremendously over long periods. So we have the so-called Easterlin paradox. Extraordinary riches by the standards of those who lived 100 years ago, absolutely extraordinary, don't seem to be, in the data anyway, securing a feeling of greater happiness. The same sorts of things many of us, including Warwick research teams, have replicated since the early 70s when Easterlin first suggested this idea. Here I've clipped in a few countries, just taken randomly, essentially get the same pattern everywhere. You'll notice that Italy, this is 1974 to the last year or two, Italy is trending upwards in recorded levels of life satisfaction in that country, but in general, we see these kinds of flat trends. Netherlands and Sweden and Ireland and Denmark tend to come top of world happiness league tables. That is the rankings that we generate across countries when we do our best to ask standardized happiness or quality of life questions. The bottom line anyway is, apart from the fact there are some wiggles that correspond roughly speaking to business cycles, and I'll come back to that, the trend through almost all of these, though not Italy, the trend is flat. I won't talk in detail about this, but if you're interested, the kinds of data sets we use are these, and these are random sample surveys of our kinds of nations. I suppose we now have happiness data on about 100 countries, although it tends to just be for the rich countries, the developed countries, that we have year after year after year measures so that we can learn about the longitudinal patterns. That's roughly speaking clear to you. We estimate happiness regression equations. So typically some measure of mental well-being will be the Y variable, the dependent variable, then we fit a giant best-fitting line through a scatter of points, and these are the sorts of structures that come out. I will return to them. The good news is that in most, although he hasn't been reading the polls recently, in most nations, people report a great deal of happiness with their lives. If you've never seen a happiness distribution or life satisfaction distribution, this is typically what it looks like. So this is from the British Household Panel study, about 80,000 randomly sampled people. You're asked a question, how satisfied are you with your life? Please give an answer from 1 to 7, where 7 is, I'm completely satisfied with my life. 1 is, I'm completely dissatisfied, and so on. You can see this skewness, which is the characteristic of the data. There's no real sense in which we use these numbers as integers. Really, all the statistical methods are driven off the ordering, but I just report the nature of the distribution if you're interested. Life is a mixture of ups and downs, and these are the kinds of things that produce big effects. Today is not the day to show you all of these patterns. Some people in the audience, if you are a Warwick student, may have seen some of this from me before. I thought it was fun, as you're young and many people here won't have seen this. This is one of the giant patterns in happiness surveys. We all have to learn to live with this. If you're a typical person, most of you are going to slide down that giant U, run flat, and then go high. Some of us in the room, particularly those nearer to the front, well, we've already been through the minimum. And the good news for us is we're on the way up now. The less good news is, well, we don't have so far to run, I suppose, as all of you. This is the structure for a mean person. Now, we've seen this. This has been replicated by probably in hundreds of research papers now. We see the same kinds of patterns in many mental health measures. This is the probability of depression by age. This is about 1 million observations here. Every dot represents, as I recall, about 10,000 people averaged. And I just show this to you. These are men in Great Britain. And this is equivalent to the probability, I'm afraid, of clinical depression maximizes in the 40s. In other words, it's the equivalent of the bottom of the U-shape in happiness. It's essentially the same for women, very, very fractionally different. What about money? There are very strong patterns in the data showing that richer people are happier and healthier. And I'll skip through the technical detail. One way to try and inquire into causality here, because of course in most of this work we're picking up, they may be very interesting patterns, but these just are literally speaking raw correlations. One way to inquire into the causal structure of all of this is to try to follow people through time. This is what some of our latest research has been doing, seeing them before they get a windfall and after. That's what some of my colleagues at Zurich and Warwick have been involved in. I don't know whether you can guess what happens to you if you get a large win on the, well, let's say a fairly large win on the lottery. We're tracking these individuals through time, measuring their mental health and their happiness. We see them 6 months after they get a lottery win, and there's no effect in the data. Just a really extraordinary result. We have one person in our data in the German panel who wins approximately $1 million. This is a woman. I don't know her name, of course. These are anonymized data. And she reports a substantial fall in her satisfaction with life and finances the following year. She's just received in her bank account $1 million. We don't know why this is, although we have some theories. Intriguingly, if you wait in the data, then you start to find effects. In the German panel, 3 years after people win the lottery, 2.5 literally, you see a big rise in their reported satisfaction with their lives. Quite an extraordinary pattern, and we don't understand it. One argument that we have been exploring is maybe people have deep feelings about what you might call their deservingness, their feelings of just desert over the income that they get. If this generalizes to bonus receivers in financial companies, maybe the year that they get their bonus, they're not going to feel nearly as cheery with life as they thought they would. We don't know. Literally speaking, if you take the British Household Panel, you take a measure of mental health, this is something called the GHQ score, you look at people 2 years before and 2 years after, we can reject the null hypothesis of no change. Or in other words, mental strain drops a lot by 2 years after a lottery win. But these patterns are incredibly interesting and keep us awake. It kept me awake somewhat last night. We just cannot understand what's going on in detail in the data. Big sum of money falls on somebody. They report, if anything, lower life satisfaction and financial satisfaction that year. It takes a long time before they start reporting greater happiness. Where will research head in the future? In the last year, I've started to work more and more on the edge of biology and economics. Of course, many of my colleagues in economics around the world think this is a very strange thing to do. But when colleagues and I started working on happiness and mental health data in the early 90s, they thought that was a very strange thing to do then. Could we, should we use biological measures, physiological measures, in part to replace GDP? And our latest work is looking at statistical links between the operation of my heart and my income and my recorded happiness and mental health. Now, why on earth would we look at the heart? Well, one reason is, of course, we know from clinicians that high blood pressure is a sign of mental strain. When I come and speak in front of a small number of hundreds of people, my blood pressure, no doubt marginally, maybe even substantially, rises. We know high blood pressure is a sign of anxiety. We know that high heart rate is a sign of anxiety. So the idea I'm contemplating, I'm pretty sure none of this is written down on my website or explained to journalists yet, so I suppose in some sense it's confidential. Or, you know, at least we haven't written up the papers. We're going to look at patterns of blood pressure and heart rate and how they relate to well-being measures in countries. We know that high blood pressure shows up negatively in life satisfaction equations. We have released one paper just a few months ago showing that if you look across countries, the countries that are very happy, not so happy, and not happy at all, there's a close match between the happiness ratings and the levels of hypertension in those countries. So high happiness goes with low hypertension, goes with low blood pressure in this systematic way across the rich European nations. We have a lot to learn about all of this. In our latest work, we're looking at, we have a data on about 100,000 randomly sampled British people, and we have physiological readings on all these people, including happiness accounts from the individuals in the data. Once we control for everything we have statistically, we find that for every 30,000 a year extra that you earn, your heart rate slows one beat a minute. Again, I couldn't honestly say I was anticipating this, but I just thought, well, let's do some interesting social science and science and try and see what kinds of patterns we get. I don't know whether you can read this equation, but so this is on our data of about 80,000 randomly sampled British people. We're getting other countries. This is an OLS pulse equation. In other words, we're taking heart rate readings on these people, resting heart rate. That's the Y variable, the dependent variable in a regression equation. You could argue about what the exact causal interpretation of this is, of course, but if you could read it, you find that older people have a slower heart rate. Men have about 2.5 beats a minute slower as their heart rate, if you can read minus 2.6. Heavier people have a faster heart rate. Taller people have a slower heart rate. There's a very strong educational gradient. So somebody who graduates with a PhD has about 2 beats a minute heart rate slower than everybody else, ceteris paribus. Married people have a slower heart rate. Unemployed people have a higher heart rate and so on. Of course, smoking cigarettes is not a good idea. We control insofar as we can for the amount of fruit and vegetables you eat, and that's, if you can read this, closely correlated with your heart rate. But the most remarkable thing is that there's no way I can drive income away from this equation. I can't drive income statistically insignificant. And that's what takes me back to this really intriguing, powerful correlation between how rich you are and how slow your heart rate is. Even when I've controlled for what kind of degree you have, what kind of fruit and vegetables you eat, you know, your weight and your height, many things about you. And it may be that high income makes people more relaxed, less anxious in life, that slows down their heart rate. It may be that heart rate is a kind of physiological measure in a deep sense of human well-being. We know, too, if we use these kinds of data, there are very close matches between happiness readings and slower heart rate readings. Insofar as my economics colleagues at Warwick know anything about this work, they might think it at best unconventional. Probably economists across Britain would think there's somewhere between unconventional and mad. But I'm inclined to think that one day, you never know, it might turn out to be something to care about. Just before I stop and take questions, I thought it would be interesting to say one other thing about the borderline between health and happiness. The way the mind controls the body is extraordinarily interesting. Probably nobody here has ever heard of the so-called wound healing experiments in stress, have they? There's been a recent interesting set of experiments where people are paid quite a lot of money to come into the lab and they have holes punched in their skin. These are standardized sized holes. I've never said that sentence before. So they have standardized holes punched in their skin, and then they go away, and they come back every week, and the doctors measure how quickly the holes in their skin heal. Now, it turns out that if you measure the people's stress just before they get the, you know, before they do all this stuff, and you ask how whether they're married, you ask about their income, those things are extremely predictive of how quickly the punch holes in their skin heal. People with lower stress levels have faster healing rates. Of course, this is a long way from traditional economics, but it's one of the, I think, incredibly interesting signals that the mind and the body are closely linked. There's more evidence of that from some work I've been involved in, but let me explain. One of the path-breaking papers was written by two medics called Redlmeyer and Singh in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And they decided to try and investigate the notion that social status and success might be protective for the health of the body. The long-standing idea here is that success and money and good things somehow improve your immune system. So they took all the Oscar winners they could find, compared the Oscar winners to those who were merely nominated for an Oscar. Right, a pretty good control group. And they argue that Oscar winners, compared to those controls, live 4 years longer. The notion being that the success boosts their immune system in some way we don't remotely understand, to be honest with you, and somehow their health is improved. Now, the statistics in this paper have been criticized, including by me, but something like this is probably true in the data. We've recently published the equivalent kind of study on Nobel scientists, and we find that they live a little bit under 2 years longer than those merely nominated for the Nobel Prize in Economics. In case you don't know, it's pretty hard to be nominated for the Nobel Prize in science. So we took data on every Nobel laureate in the hard sciences over this period. There's a 50-year moratorium from the Swedish Academy where you can get the names of the nominees after 50 years is up. Otherwise, the data are confidential. So various kinds of tests were done, and I'll flick through this. But literally speaking, if you correct the statistics in a way that Redlmeyer and Singh didn't do to get the best possible match, it does appear that Nobel Prize winners get a kind of longevity boost, rather remarkably, than those who are merely nominated. There's much to be understood about the links between happiness, economic forces, and physical health. Let me end with four speculations. I imagine that, although I'm not allowed to talk about the details of the Stiglitz Commission, but I imagine that in the spring we will release a report saying that we should replace GDP in some form. I can't tell you what form. As social scientists, I'm coming to believe that we need better understanding of the links between the mind and the body, between how income affects, how money can slow my heart rate, even when we've controlled for everything. What are the interconnections at a deep level between my mental health and the health of my whole physical system? When I was a young man, as a research economist, I never dreamed, of course, I should emphasize, I would ever be giving talks about such things. I think, though almost nobody in the world agrees with me, that heart rate and blood pressure data have particular potential. It wouldn't surprise me if in the year 2050, governments released GDP data and heart rate data. I know it sounds a very strange thing in 2009. And finally, I think social scientists will collaborate more and more with doctors, with hard scientists, and with epidemiologists, because we need to learn more about these incredibly interesting and puzzling interactions between the state of the mind and the state of the body. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to take questions if that's sensible. I have a question right at the back, for example, immediately.
Yes, right at the beginning, you produced data that said there's sort of a cutoff point for happiness with increasing income. Is that right? And then gave us...
A plateau point, did you say?
Yeah, plateau point, sorry, yeah. And then gave us data showing that with more wealth, there's more happiness, etc. Is that inconsistent?
I'm not sure if I gave you a plateau point for happiness and income. There's a big debate about this, and I think that the balance of the evidence is that for individuals... happiness is an approximately logarithmic function of income. In other words, it rises in a flattening way. It's a concave function from below. This is tremendously debated, the exact detail. But I think for individuals, though we have these puzzling results about lottery winners and it takes time, but for individuals, the richer you will be, the happier you will be on average. I'm afraid it's going to flatten off when you get to your second Ferrari. But... unfortunately, it doesn't work the same for countries. As we all go from one BMW to two BMWs each to three BMWs, countries don't seem to get happier at all. Maybe that's what you meant by the plateauing. Do come back if I haven't answered that question. Okay. This gentleman's got his hand up, but I don't know whether I'm meant to choose the questions, am I?
Again, related to income. What about if the income is not constant? So if I bonuses, bankers with bonuses, yes. Obviously they rely on income and happiness. And then how does that also relate to their health?
Yes. I'm afraid we don't know a lot about that. It's an incredibly interesting topic. I mean, I would say that the windfall studies, like the ones that I've been involved in, are the closest we get to that. One person, an American, has published a paper looking at windfalls, lottery windfalls, and physical health, and argues that they're beneficial for physical health. But his sample is very small. There's a lot of debate about this paper. Once I got a finance company to agree to let me see people just before they got giant bonuses and afterwards, and then at the last minute they withdrew from the study. I think they were nervous about what I might say in the press or whatever. So we just genuinely have very little proper science about what happens to a person after he or she gets, let's say, £100,000, £1,000,000. Just casual observation amongst my friends who decided not to be economics professors and wanted to make money, a casual observation is they don't actually seem any happier to me or healthier than the ones who stuck to £100,000 a year as a professor or whatever. But that's mere anecdote. We could really do with proper scientific studies on the physical health of people before a vast drop of money and afterwards. Should I choose or? Yes, there's a gentleman at the back and then we'll work across if that's all right.
Yes. Thank you. We saw evidence of a correlation from individuals' income to their happiness. I'm just wondering if any research has been done on what affects that relationship. So, for example, if there are any particular groups of society where that's stronger or weaker or whatever. Thank you.
Yes. You raise a very good question, if I may say so. I would say the main thing we know is that there's a lot of robustness or stability, or in other words, interaction terms in these kinds of regressions, if I can use that language, don't show up very strongly. But I would go back in a way to what I said to the first question, and that is we know... or at least we believe there's a lot of curvature. So we really think in happiness data, there is the diminishing marginal utility that we teach students in first year. As far as I know, that's the main interaction effect. That's the main thing that affects the gradient of happiness and income. Should we work across? There's a lady just to next to you. Yeah.
I think having a meaning or a purpose in life have substantial effects on happiness. Firstly, do you agree with that? And secondly, how do you think money or income helps with that? Thank you.
Okay. I don't know how money helps with that. I suppose I think of them all as additively separable. In other words, I tend to think, maybe I've brainwashed myself, but I tend to think in terms of a regression equation with a coefficient on this thing, another coefficient on that thing, and that fits the data reasonably well. Now, just from common observation in my life, I suppose I reckon that, I forget how you put it now, but having a goal or caring about things might be much more important than money, and I've seen that. That's very hard to pick up in our regression equations for happiness or mental health because I don't know how to measure it. But curiously, although I'm not religious, one does find that people who tick the I believe in God or I go to church boxes, they show up with a kind of happiness premium in the data, controlling for everything else. This is not a recommendation from me to you to believe in a deity or to go to church. I'm just reporting a statistical pattern. But that's consistent with the notion, perhaps you'd call it meaning in life, but that's consistent with the notion that some people get meaning in their life on top of all the other things that I've shown you in happiness regression equations. Would you like to respond to that? Was that sufficient? Okay.
Hi. I have two comments / questions. So the first one is quite interesting how the pulse is lower with every 30,000 pounds. What would happen if we considered the relationship the other way around? So we earn more because our pulse is smaller.
That's a very, very good point, a very good thing to think about. At the moment, because we haven't even written up these results as papers yet, I haven't decided how to address that. Of course, most of my life as an applied economist is spent trying to think about there's an identification problem, two functions cutting, or two different ways to see things. How can I sort out the real causality? I don't know yet. Now, your point is an excellent one. All we know at this stage is there's this very deep correlation that I can't drive away, and we will be doing more work on that. Because the coefficient is so robust when I control for things like exercise as well. I don't think I showed you our exercise variables. I'm inclined to think that your interpretation, though it's very sensible intellectually, is not practically the correct one in the data. But we don't know.
And another one is, how do you think expectations affect our happiness? So, for example, if we are born in a rich family, we expect to be earning £200,000. Are we going to be less happy if we earn £100,000 in comparison to the person who is expecting to be earning £30,000 and gets £100,000?
Yes, if I had one good piece of advice for you, it would be keep your aspirations really low in life. I spent the last 3 months or so on sabbatical at the University of Zurich, and one of the professors there has just studied more or less this question and has taken three generations of data on income and happiness and many other things, and shows that if your father, sorry, it was focused on the men, forgive me, but if your father earned a lot, then caetus paribus, other things constant, you are less happy controlling for your own income. Okay, so it's, although people are not aware that this is goes on in their heads, and their fathers aren't aware either, but it's as though there are very deep, you could call them envy effects or comparison effects. My father was a professor. I remember thinking, you know, he's... Now, perhaps I shan't go into that. But I would recommend to all of you in your 20s that if you can come to terms with how you react to and think about and compare yourself to your parents, that's a huge psychological advantage in life. Most of us take some decades to manage to do that. So human beings can't shake off these comparisons.
Hi. I was wondering, how do you actually obtain the data for happiness for each observation? You mentioned that you interview people or something, but isn't it quite tricky to ask someone how happy are you?
Yes, it is tricky. It's done many ways, and everyone has to agree to be part of this random sample survey. The encouraging thing is that it doesn't matter exactly how we measure happiness or life satisfaction or mental health we've discovered. And that gives me confidence that the patterns that we uncover with one kind of measure in one data set really are telling us something, because we see a tremendous amount of replication. So I can show you life satisfaction equations, happiness equations, sleeping equations, mental health equations. They all have the same econometric structure. We will always worry about the subjective answers. That's partly why I'm going to physiological data, showing that there is this close match between I say I'm happy, I've actually got a slower pulse rate, I've actually got a lower blood pressure rate, and so on. At the moment, in 09, it's the best we can do.
Thank you. You presented the data that contrasted heartbeat and income. So I was wondering, is the correlation between heartbeat and income and happiness and health linear, or is it maybe the other way around? So, for example, if I earn a lot, I'm happy, but I'm not so healthy. You know what I'm trying to ask?
I think I know what you're trying to ask. But I think all our evidence is that earning more tends to improve your health. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is some evidence that we've just produced showing that when you get promoted, your mental strain score rises. After a promotion, you're under more stress, which is somewhat what one would anticipate. But the links are very powerful between income and health. I mean, they're very probably two-way, but that's the balance of the evidence. I'm hoping that's answered your question. Whether it's literally linear, I'm afraid we just don't know.
Yeah, hi. So if the point of finding a new kind of indicator rather than GDP to measure sort of general well-being or whatever it is that David Cameron said, yep, is to guide policy, then how are these kind of indicators relating to heart rate going to have to look like in order to prevent governments from compulsing their citizens into mandatory fitness schemes and whatnot? So, what's it going to look like? I mean, it's early, of course.
I mean, that's an excellent thing to worry about. I'm afraid I haven't worried about it, though. I'm just trying to think about how intellectually we could construct these measures. And perhaps I should worry more about it, but I suppose that my instinct as a social scientist is to just try and get the intellectual issues straight, you see. I don't know whether that's boringly scientific, but that's my approach. It would concern me if I were presenting papers or working on things with an eye to exactly how they were going to be used for policy. Now, you might think that's a bad thing for Andrew Oswald to say, but I'm inclined to think that we just have to pursue intellectual things to get to the bottom of truth with a capital T, and then we'll worry about how to cope with that for policy. By the way, I've seen many happiness regression equations where exercise comes in really strongly positive, particularly for children, actually, although that's not widely known. So it might not be a bad economic policy to get us to be taking more exercise. I wouldn't be surprised if there's not a true cause and effect relationship between exercise and happiness. But we genuinely don't know.
From what I understood, the goal of GDP growth is merely important as far as it increases general well-being and happiness, people's happiness. That's what I kind of translated from what you said.
Well, I think I want to stick up for happiness as a measure, and most post-war politicians in the West, of course, have thought that we should try to boost GDP as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But do go on.
So perhaps that after a certain point, GDP per capita, growth in GDP per capita has not a significant effect on increasing happiness. Perhaps I actually looked into this once, and there is a certain point above which it doesn't really affect happiness or general well-being. I guess after people reach their essential needs and exceed those needs, it doesn't really affect them. So how would you consider that? Do you have any comment regarding that?
My comment would be that's an empirical issue that we need to settle with data, and it goes back to perhaps the very first question that I was asked. All I can say is that for an individual, we think that happiness is a logarithmic function of income. In other words, there's quite well-determined diminishing marginal utility. But for whole countries, for the rich countries, as they get richer, they don't get happier. If you take a scatter plot for individual countries where every dot is a country, you've got happiness on the y-axis, GDP on the x-axis, then it looks like it's a concave function from below, which is somewhat consistent with what you've said. But the scientific quality of that as evidence is extremely low. You know, if I show you 60 dots on a scatter plot and make some claim about cause and effect, then I'm in very tricky social science territory. That doesn't make it wrong, but I'm doubtful of those curved graphs, which you see a bit in the literature, that are just cross-section scatter plots for nations.
Do you see a danger in using happiness as a goal for policy and for using paternalistic policies and maybe justifying the U-shaped happiness curve over age by saying, sort of, you'll thank us later for this, you'll be happy about this later?
I do think there's a danger of paternalism with governments trying to control happiness excessively. Yes, I think there's a danger of that. I don't think governments can do too much about the U-shape of happiness through the life cycle because we see it in data all over the world, and I think it's out of the control of politicians. I think it's deep within ourselves. It's probably even out of our own control. Some people take happiness data and mental well-being data and use this as a sort of excuse for left-wing policies. A few even use it as an excuse for right-wing policies. That's not my approach to social science in life. You know, it seems important that almost all of the researchers keep their political views out of the data, you know? And I can't think of what else to say. I do have political views, but I suppose I just don't talk about them. On platforms like this, I prefer to talk about the patterns in numbers and what we should believe about our world. But yes, there is some danger of paternalism, maybe particularly over happiness numbers compared to over GDP numbers. I think that you raise a fair issue.
Thank you. It was really very interesting lecture, and I just find quite an amazing the chart that you showed that it between the 41 and 50 is the age when we feel the most unhappy.
43 is the
okay. Minimum. Okay, but then we are kind of reached the peak of our career and we have a good income.
Exactly.
So, any thoughts on this? How do you explain that?
Yes. The U-shape is, I should explain, usually drawn from a long regression equation where we control for everything like income and all the success. In raw British data, it exists even without doing that regression equation correction. I suppose that most researchers in the field believe that the U-shape is somehow generated by aspirations that are out of control. So you are very sensibly, you're looking for the real X factors in my Y happiness equation, and they just don't match up. So the standard theory is, early on in my life, I think I'm going to do all these incredible things. Then in my 40s, I haven't done them. And, you know, some of you will achieve what you want, and many of you won't. And probably the secret of happiness is keeping a balance, you know, somehow. But it's not the actual achievements, but rather the aspiration gaps that we think control this. It's speculation, scientifically.
Well, to add to the question, and also you mentioned that richness does not necessarily mean happiness, but what would you comment on the statistics that actually some of the richest countries have the highest suicide rate?
Yes. Suicide rate are a very important source of data, a very sad source of data. And this gentleman, just in case you didn't hear right at the back, is reminding me that many rich countries have high suicide rates. The honest thing to say to that is we don't know why that is. I don't think even the suicide specialists know that. It may be that, and we have some evidence for this, just published in the Journal of the European Economic Association, it may be that suicide is driven also by gaps between what you aspire to. and what you can achieve, not all of it, of course. We know that suicide risk appears to be monotonically linked to your relative wage. So it's if you have low standing in society relative to what's normal, then your suicide risk is substantially higher. In other words, it's not, again, it's not your absolute things in life, but rather it's how you compare to the hierarchy. We know, too, there are cultural norms on suicide, and that suicide, once you factor out country, what are called country fixed effects, the unchanging things about countries, we know that there's a much closer link between income and happiness and suicide. But I don't think any scientist or social scientist in the world understands why many people, about one in 10,000 men in the rich countries will kill themselves every year. About one in 10,000. That's when we have everything in life compared to those hundreds of years ago. I feel like maybe we should have some questions from the back if the gentlemen with the mics want to, yes.
Hi, I was wondering how this model differs in the developing world.
Yes. To the best of our knowledge, in the developing world, GDP is a good thing for countries. I don't think that's so surprising. In other words, if you haven't got more than the minimum to eat, then economic growth is a good thing. So I don't think that the Easterlin paradox applies to, let's say, almost all of the African nations, to India, and so on. Also, the data are far better on the rich countries, as you might guess. It's in those developed nations where we have really quite good random samples of citizens, which started around 1972 in a lot of countries, giving us the happiness readings. Beyond that, if you do take developing nations data, and we have some micro data sets like that, and you estimate these happiness regression equations, the same general structures come out. In other words, many people in very poor countries have replicated the U-shape through the life cycle, though not with the same minimum point. Income buys happiness. There's a strong association between relationships like marriage and happiness and so on. But we have a great deal to learn about developing countries. Of course, in a way, that's a more important area, to my mind, than developed countries.
Hi. What advice could you give for the experimental design and the means of obtaining data for in order to get interpretable results? And say, especially given that you're dealing with very abstract concepts such as happiness or health even. So what advice out of your experience could you give to, say,
teachers? So you're asking, as it were, for research advice on how to design research procedure or your research projects and so on?
For instance, yeah. Do you rely on questionnaires, or do you rely more, say, on interviews?
Typically, we have, like most economists, we've relied on secondary data sets, anonymized data sources, where I don't meet anyone and I don't know their names or ask any questions as it were, statistical analysts. We don't do that. The older I've got, the more I have come to think that probably economists should do more qualitative research, a bit more like the sociologists and others. I think that's been a weakness of post-war economics. It's been likened to the idea that economists are up in an aeroplane looking down with very powerful lenses on the world, trying to understand the patterns that they see, and that it might be a good thing if the economists actually landed, went out and spoke to the citizens. There's a rather nice quote from a man called Alan Blinder, a very distinguished American macroeconomist, who's talking about the failures of economics to confront the detail of life. And he said, if molecules could talk, would physicists refuse to listen? And I always thought that was rather a profound thing to say. My discipline has this long tradition of not wanting to listen to what people say about their own lives, except in this very stylized, anonymized, we've got all these people, they're dots on my screen, I'm going to estimate my regression equation sense. Beyond that, I'd love to persuade some of you to become researchers, by the way. With the financial markets crashing and economics getting even more interesting every day, salaries rising strongly in universities, this is an incredibly exciting time for you to think, will it really make you happy to go in there 8 to 7 and make a lot of money and get a faster car? Why not come and work in our PhD program, discover incredibly exciting things about the world, and make a lasting intellectual and social welfare contribution. If you're at all sympathetic to that idea, send me an email or just think about it in your own time. My life has come out very well, even though there was a juncture where I very nearly became a city economist. I would undoubtedly have been richer, but you know, I have plenty of money, really. What am I going to, you know, I have a car, I have a house. What am I going to buy? I think being a researcher is just a fantastic life, and I strongly recommend you to go on in graduate work in whatever field you care about, but preferably in our field.
Hi, Jim Carrey once said something to the effect of, "I wish everyone could get rich and famous so they'd know it doesn't make you happy." Is there anything in your data that shows that at low and middle levels of income, the relationship between income and happiness holds, but at very high levels, there's actually a negative relation?
This is an important issue, and it does come up again and again. Thank you for raising it. We have touched on it before with the idea of the concavity of happiness and income. The closest I've come to seeing evidence of the kind that you might wish is in our large lottery winner data. And at least on this day in 2009, I believe that effect, the kind of neutrality effect, goes away, and eventually winners become happier. So countries, I think, don't, once they've already got plenty of material things like ours, I don't think countries become happier as they get richer. But there is, in the data, a positive association between income and happiness. And we have very few people in our data who earn a million or 10 million. I have no reason to think that it goes literally flat. I'm inclined to think the gradient gets very small and that they don't get as much fun out of the £1 million as they would out of being a really good researcher discovering how the world works, or, you know, being a really interesting poet, or doing important work for a voluntary organization, and so on. But the data show a monotonic relationship, insofar as we can test it, between happiness and income. Maybe we'll just take two more questions, if that seems reasonable.
Hi. I wonder if the data you have presented is not focusing on just one type of personality. And in the ones, for example, for the Oscar winners, certain type of personality, certain type of people need a pat on the back to say, yes. Oh, yeah, I feel good. When you had that self-assertiveness coming from the crowd, feel better, break through some mental barriers. Some other people may have a different set of values, and more money necessarily doesn't mean more or better or more happiness. For some other people, for comparison, it does mean. So putting that data into context with the personality and with the values of a person may give maybe a better direction.
I think you argue very well. There are two things to say. First of all, essentially all the patterns I've shown you are just for the means, in a sense. I mean, we may correct the means with fancy statistical techniques, but it boils down to finding averages, looking at the pattern for the average person, or the average life. So I cannot explain every dot on my computer screen just as it were the mean or the median. There has been, in the last few months, more work on personality and happiness. We're finding very strong effects from baseline personality onto human well-being, just as one might expect. So in the long run, we will be able to put together marriage and personality and income and health and so on. But currently, we just haven't done very much of that.
So starting on the other end of a happy person brings wealth and health to its life.
I'm not sure if I've understood you. Health brings happiness?
No,
is that what you're asking
me? If you are a happy person, would that bring health and wealth to your life? As opposite of money, success brings happiness to you.
Yes. I'm inclined to think that happiness does have positive effects onto wealth and onto other things. In other words, happiness in a deep model has to be treated as a driving variable and not just one that's molded by other things. At Warwick, we've just released a paper at the end of December showing that there are links between happiness and productivity. Perhaps I won't go into the details now I come to think about it, but yes, I think happiness does things. It's not just merely a response. Final question, if I may.
Do you run into problems controlling for cultural and linguistic norms in the reporting of happiness across countries? I mean, countries that appear happier, it may just be that they have the way they describe their, you know, state of life, linguistically yes. or culturally. Maybe.
Okay, the question, just in case you didn't catch it, is should we be controlling better or trying harder to adjust for culture, the way countries use language, the way countries even express their feelings, and so on? Researchers have worried about that for many decades, and there have been various kinds of attempts to control for that. I would say that we can do it quite well now. Why do I say that? Well, remember, I've shown you corroborating patterns with hypertension, with blood pressure. In other words, in the last few decades, we've learned about ways to match these subjective responses in different languages to physiological measures. Your general point is an extremely astute one, and I think we've made some progress on it. I propose to stop unless anyone is absolutely dying to ask a question. No, I'm afraid I've been told to draw it to a close. Thank you very much, and don't forget, become a researcher if you possibly can.